A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. Chapters 10, 11, and 12. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 10. Parental Affection. Parental affection is perhaps the blindest kind of perverse self-love. Parents often love their children in the most animal-like manner, and sacrifice every duty to others in order to promote their children's advancement in the world. They aim to promote the future welfare of the offspring, whose present existence the parents make bitter by their bullying use of power. That's a sign of how perverse and unprincipled prejudice can be. In fact, every kind of power wants to reign without control or inquiry. Its throne is built across a dark abyss that no eye must dare to explore, for fear that the baseless structure might totter under investigation. Obedience, unconditional obedience, is the catchword of tyrants of every description, and to make assurance doubly sure, one kind of despotism supports another. Tyrants would have cause to tremble if reason were to become the rule of duty, in any of the relations of life, for then the light might spread until perfect day appeared. And when it did appear, men would smile at the sight of the bugbears that had made them jump during the night of ignorance, or the twilight of timid inquiry. If man's great privilege is the power of reflecting on the past and peering speculatively into the future, it must be granted that some people enjoy this privilege in a very limited degree. Everything new appears to them wrong, and not able to distinguish what could happen from what couldn't, they fear where there should be no place for fear, running from the light of reason as if it were a firebrand. Woman, however, being in every situation a slave to prejudice, seldom exerts enlightened maternal affection, or she either neglects her children or spoils them by undue permissiveness. Also, the affection of many women for their children is, I repeat, very brutish, because it eradicates every spark of humanity. Justice, truth, everything, is sacrificed by these Rebeccas, and for the sake of their own children they violate the most sacred duties, forgetting the common relationship that binds the whole family on earth together. Yet reason seems to say that someone who allows one duty or affection to swallow up the rest doesn't have enough heart or mind to fulfil even that one conscientiously. As the care of children in their infancy is one of the grand duties that naturally fall to the female character, this duty, if it were properly considered, would provide many forcible arguments for strengthening the female understanding. The formation of the mind must be begun very early, and the temperament, in particular, requires the most judicious attention. And that attention can't be paid by women who love their children only because they are their children, and don't try to base their duty on anything deeper than the feelings of the moment. It is this lack of reason in their affections that makes so many women be the most foolishly attentive mothers, or, at the other extreme, the most careless and unnatural ones. To be a good mother, a woman must have sense, and also the independence of mind, that is possessed by few women who are taught to depend entirely on their husbands. Meek wives are usually foolish mothers. They want their children to love them best, and to side with them in a secret conspiracy against the father. He is held up as a scarecrow, the one who must punish them if they have offended the mother, the one who must be the judge in all disputes. But I'll discuss this subject more fully when I deal with private education. At present, I want only to insist that unless woman's understanding is enlarged, and her character made more firm by her being allowed to govern her own conduct, she will never have enough sense or command of temperament to manage her children properly. A woman who doesn't breastfeed her children hardly counts as having parental affection, because the performance of this duty contributes equally to maternal and filial affection. And it is the indispensable duty of men and women to fulfil the duties that give rise to the affections that are the surest preservatives against vice. So-called natural affection is a very weak tie, I think. Affections that strongly bond people together must grow out of the habitual exercise of a mutual sympathy, and a mother who sends her babe to a nurse, and only takes it from a nurse to send it to a school, what sympathy does she exercise? In the exercise of their natural feelings, women have been provided by God with a natural substitute for love. When the husband-lover becomes only a friend, and overstrained admiration is replaced by mutual confidence, a child then gently retightens the relaxing cord between husband and wife, and their shared attention to the child produces a new mutual sympathy. But a child won't enliven the affections of the parents if they are content to transfer the charge to hirelings. Those who do their duty by having someone do it for them shouldn't complain if they miss the reward of duty, namely the child's dutifulness towards them. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11. Duty to Parents. Man seems to have a lazy tendency to make prescription, legal enforcement, always take the place of reason. The rights of kings are deduced in a direct line from the King of Kings, and that of parents from our first parent. Why do we thus go back for principles that should always rest on the same base and have the same weight today that they had 1,000 years ago, and not a jot more? If parents do their duty, they have a stronghold and sacred claim on the gratitude of their children. But few parents are willing to receive the respectful affection of their offspring on those terms. They demand blind obedience, because they don't deserve a reasonable service that their children might willingly provide with their eyes open. And to make these demands of weakness and ignorance more binding, a mysterious sanctity is spread around the most arbitrary principle. Arbitrary? Well, what other name can be given to the blind duty of obeying vicious or weak beings, merely because they obeyed a powerful instinct, namely, the instinct for sexual coupling that caused the children to come into existence in the first place? The simple definition of the two-way duty that naturally holds between parent and child can be stated in a few words. The parent who pays proper attention to helpless infancy has a right to require the same attention when the feebleness of age comes upon him. But to subjugate a rational being to the mere will of another, when he is old enough to answer to society for his own conduct, is cruel and improper, and it may be as harmful to morality as the religious systems that make God's will the sole source of the line between right and wrong. I never knew a parent who had paid more than common attention to his children, who was then disregarded by the children. On the contrary, the opinion of a respected parent is something the child is apt to rely on almost unquestioningly, this being an early habit that is not easy to shake off, even when mature reason convinces the child that his father is not the wisest man in the world. This is an attractive weakness, but it is a weakness, and a reasonable man should steel himself against it, because the all-too-common belief that one is obliged to obey a parent just because he is one's parent shackles the mind and prepares it for a slavish submission to any power but reason. I distinguish the natural duty to parents from the accidental duty to parents. The parent who carefully tries to form the heart and enlarge the understanding of his child is performing a duty that is common to the whole animal world, while giving it a dignity that only reason can provide. This is the parental affection of humanity, and leaves instinctive natural affection far behind. Such a parent acquires all the rights of the most sacred friendship, and his advice, even when his child is fully adult, demands serious consideration. With respect to marriage, after 21 years, a parent seems to have no right to withhold his consent for any reason. But 20 years of parental care deserve something in return, and the son ought at least to promise not to marry for 2 or 3 years, if the woman of his choice doesn't entirely meet with the approval of his first friend. But respect for parents is, generally speaking, a much less elevated cause of action. It is only a selfish respect for property. The father who is blindly obeyed is obeyed from sheer weakness, or from motives that degrade the human character. Much of the misery that wanders in hideous forms around the world is allowed to rise from the negligence of parents, and yet these are the people who cling most tightly to what they call a natural right, though it undermines man's birthright, the right to act as his own reason directs. I have already often pointed out that vicious or idle people are always eager to profit from the enforcement of arbitrary privileges, usually in proportion to their neglect of the duties that might make the privileges reasonable. This is basically a dictate of the instinct of self-defence that is typical of ignorant weakness, resembling the instinct that makes a fish muddy the water it swims in to escape its enemy, instead of boldly facing it in the clear stream. The supporters of any kind of prescription do indeed fly from the clear stream of argument, taking refuge in the darkness that has been supposed to surround God's throne. They dare to demand the immediate and total respect that is due only to his unsearchable ways. Don't misunderstand me. The darkness that hides our God from us only concerns speculative truths. It never obscures moral ones, which shine clearly. Females in all countries are too much under the dominion of their parents, and few parents think of addressing their children like this. It is in your interest to obey me until you can judge for yourself. And God, the Almighty Father of all, has implanted in me an affection to serve as your guardian while your reason is unfolding. But when your mind reaches maturity, you must obey me, or rather respect my opinions, only to the extent that they coincide with the light that is breaking in on your own mind. A slavish bondage to parents cramps every faculty of the mind. Locke was right when he said that, if the mind is curbed and humbled too much in children, if their spirits are abased and broken by too strict a hand over them, they lose all their vigour and industry. This strict hand may to some extent explain the weakness of women, because girls are, for various reasons, more kept down by their parents, in every sense of the word down, than boys are. The duty expected from them is, like all the duties arbitrarily imposed on women, based less on reason than on a sense of propriety, on respect for decorum, and by being taught slavishly to submit to their parents, girls are prepared for the slavery of marriage. I may be told that a number of women are not slaves in the marriage state. True, but they then become tyrants, for what they obtain by debasing means is not rational freedom, but a lawless kind of power, resembling the authority exercised by the favourites of absolute monarchs. Similarly, I would not dream of suggesting that either boys or girls are always slaves. I only insist that when they are obliged to submit to authority blindly, their faculties are weakened and their temperaments are made abject. I also lament that parents, lazily availing themselves of a supposed privilege, damp the first faint glimmerings of reason. They are anxious to enforce duty, but they turn that into an empty name, because they will not let it rest on the only secure basis a duty can have. For if duty is not based on knowledge, it cannot gain sufficient strength to resist the squalls of passion or the silent undermining of self-love. But the parents who have given the surest proof of their affection for their children are not the ones who most vehemently insist on their children submitting to their will, merely because it is their will. On the contrary, the parent who sets a good example patiently lets that example work, and it seldom fails to produce its natural effect, filial respect. Children cannot be taught too early to submit to reason, for submitting to reason is submitting to the nature of things, and to the God who formed them so, to promote our real interests. Why should the minds of children be warped, when they are just beginning to expand, only to favour the laziness of parents who insist on a privilege without being willing to pay the price nature has fixed for it? A right always includes a duty, and I think we can fairly infer from this that those who don't perform the duty don't retain the right. I believe that in general the affection we inspire in others always resembles the affection that we cultivate in ourselves, so that natural affections, which have been supposed to be almost distinct from reason, are more nearly connected with judgment than is commonly allowed. Indeed, the affections that merely reside in the heart, with no input from the head, seem to have a kind of animal capriciousness. I offer that as another proof of the necessity of cultivating the female understanding. It is the irregular exercise of parental authority that first injures the mind, and girls are more subject to these irregularities than boys are. The will of those who never allow their will to be disputed, except when they happen to be in a good mood, is almost always unreasonable. To elude this arbitrary authority, girls very early learn the lessons that they afterwards practice on their husbands, for I have frequently seen a little sharp-faced miss rule a whole family, excepting that now and then mamma's anger will suddenly burst out. Either her hair was ill-dressed, or she had lost more money at cards than she was willing to admit to her husband, or some such moral cause of anger. I have been led into a melancholy train of reflection about females, when their first affection must lead them astray, or make their duties clash, until they rest on mere whims and customs. Little can be expected from them as they grow older. How, indeed, can an instructor remedy this evil? For to teach children virtue on any solid principle is to teach them to despise their parents. Children ought not to be taught to make allowance for their parents' faults, because every such allowance weakens the force of reason in their minds and makes them still more indulgent to their own faults. It is a sublime virtue of maturity that leads us to be hard on ourselves and forbearing towards others. But children should be taught only the simple virtues, for if they begin too early to make allowance for human passions and manners, they'll wear off the fine edge of the criterion by which they should regulate their own. The affections of children and weak people are always selfish. They love their relatives because they are loved by them, not because of the relatives' virtues. But until esteem and love are blended together in the first affection, and reason is made the basis for the first duty, morality will stumble at the threshold. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12. National Education. The good effects of private education will always be very limited. The parent who really works at educating his children will always be somewhat disappointed until education becomes a grand national concern. A man can't pull out of society with his child, and if he did, he couldn't bring himself back to childhood and become the proper friend and playmate of an infant or youth. When children are confined to the society of men and women, they soon acquire a kind of premature manhood that stops the growth of every vigorous power of mind or body. In order to develop their faculties, they should be stimulated to think for themselves, and this can be done only by mixing a number of children together and making them jointly pursue the same objectives. A child very soon contracts a numbing indolence of mind that he seldom has sufficient vigour to shake off when, instead of seeking information for himself, he only asks some adult a question and then relies uncritically on the answer. This could never be the case for him among peers of his own age, and the things he was asking about would not be entirely under the direction of men who frequently damp or even destroy abilities by bringing them forward too hastily. Besides, in youth the seeds of every affection should be sown, and the respectful regard felt for a parent is very different from the social affections that are to constitute the happiness of life later on. Filial esteem always has a dash of fear mixed with it, so that the very respect he has for his parent will teach him cunning, or at least prevent him from pouring out the little secrets which first open the heart to friendship and confidence, gradually leading to more expansive benevolence. Added to this, he will never acquire that frank openness of behaviour that young people can attain only by being frequently in society where they dare to speak what they think, not afraid of being scolded for their presumption, or laughed at for their folly. I have formerly delivered my opinion rather warmly in favour of home rather than school education, but further experience has led me to view the subject in a different light. I still think, however, that schools, as they are now regulated, are hotbeds of vice and folly, and that the knowledge of human nature they are supposed to get there is merely cunning selfishness. When the youth are educated at home, however, although they may pursue a more orderly plan of study than is possible at school, where nearly a quarter of the year is spent in idleness, they there acquire too high an opinion of their own importance. This comes from their being allowed to tyrannize over servants, and from the influence on their manners of most mothers, who, in their eagerness to teach the accomplishments of a gentleman, stifle at their birth the virtues of a man. Thus the young become vain and effeminate, through being brought into adult company when they ought to be seriously employed in children's activities, and being treated like men when they are still boys. The only way to avoid two extremes that are equally harmful to morality would be to contrive some way of combining a public and private education. Thus, to make men citizens, two natural steps might be taken that seem to lead directly to the desired point. Cultivating the domestic affections that first open the heart to humanity in general, while also allowing the children to spend a great part of their time on terms of equality with other children. In great schools, what can do more harm to the moral character than the system of tyranny and abject slavery that is established among the boys, to say nothing of the slavery to routine formal observances, a slavery that makes religion worse than a farce? What good can be expected from the youth who receives the sacrament of the Lord's Supper so as to avoid being punished for non-attendance? Youths devote half their energies to elude the necessity of attending public worship, and well they may, for such a constant repetition of the same thing must be a very irksome restraint on their natural vivacity. These ceremonies have the most fatal effect on their morals. They are a ritual performed by the lips, and the heart and mind are far away, and our Protestant Church no longer stores them up, as the Catholic Church purports to, as a bank to draw on for the fees of the poor departed souls in purgatory, so why shouldn't they be abolished? But in this country there is a fear of any innovation. This hidden fear is really the apprehensive timidity of idle slugs, who guard the snug place that they view as an hereditary estate, eating, drinking and enjoying themselves, instead of fulfilling the duties, except a few empty formalities, for which the estate was endowed. How do they guard it? By sliming it over. These are the people who most strenuously insist on conforming to the will of the founder, crying out against every reform as if it were a violation of justice. I am now alluding particularly to the relics of popery retained in our colleges, where the Protestant members seem to be such sticklers for the established church, though their zeal never makes them lose sight of the riches that rapacious priests once scraped together from ignorant people. No, they venerate the prescriptive right of possession as a stronghold, and still let the sluggish bell ring them to prayers as during the Roman Catholic days. These Romish customs have the most baneful effect on the morals of our clergy, for a sense of duty is soon lost by the idle vermin who two or three times a day perform in a slovenly manner a service which they think useless, but call their duty. Nothing can be more irreverent than the cathedral service as it is now performed in this country, and England doesn't contain a set of weaker men than those who are the slaves of this childish routine. A disgusting skeleton of the former state is still exhibited, but all the solemn display, which engaged the imagination even if it didn't purify the heart, is stripped off. The performance of Roman Catholic High Mass on the European continent must impress anyone who has a spark of imagination with that solemn melancholy, that sublime tenderness, which is so near akin to devotion. I don't say that these devotional feelings do more moral good than any other emotion of taste, but I do say that the French Roman Catholic theatrical pomp that gratifies our senses is preferable to the English Protestant cold parade that insults the understanding without reaching the heart. These remarks can't be misplaced in discussion of national education, especially given that the supporters of these puerile establishments pretend to be the champions of religion. Religion, pure source of comfort in this vale of tears? How has your clear stream been muddied by the dabblers who have presumptuously tried to confine in one narrow channel the living waters that always flow toward God, the sublime ocean of existence? What would life be without the peace that can't be had except through the love of God, built on humanity? I have heard several masters of schools maintain that their role was connected not with boys' morals, but only with their learning Latin and Greek, and that they had done their duty by sending some good scholars to college. A few good scholars, I grant, may have been formed in this way, but to bring forward these clever boys, the health and morals of a number of others have been sacrificed. It is not for the benefit of society that a few brilliant men should be brought forward at the expense of the multitude. It is true that great men seem to spring up at proper intervals to restore order and blow away the clouds that thicken over the face of truth. But if more reason and virtue prevailed in society, these strong winds wouldn't be necessary. This train of reasoning brings me back to a subject that I want to discuss at length, the need for proper day schools. These should be national establishments. Schoolmasters in private schools depend on the whims of parents, and as long as that is so, they can't be expected to exert themselves any more than is necessary to please ignorant people. A schoolmaster has to give the parents some sample of the boy's abilities, which during the vacation is shown to every visitor to his home, and this does more harm than would at first be supposed. For usually the samples are not entirely, to put it mildly, the child's own work, so that the master goes along with falsehoods, or else the master winds the poor child's machine up to some extraordinary exertion that injures the wheels and stops the progress of gradual improvement. With disgust I have heard sensible women speak of the wearisome confinement they endured at school, obliged to walk stupidly backwards and forwards with steady deportment, holding up their heads, turning out their toes, with shoulders braced back, instead of moving vigorously and naturally in the ways that are so conducive to health. The pure animal spirits that make both mind and body develop in hopeful ways are turned sour, and are vented in vain wishes or pert regrets that contract the faculties and spoil the temper, or else they mount to the brain, make the understanding sharp before it is correspondingly strong, thereby producing the pitiful cunning that disgracefully characterizes the female mind, and I fear will continue to do so as long as women remain the slaves of power. The male world's small respect for chastity is, I am convinced, the great source of many of the physical and moral evils that torment mankind, as well as of the vices and follies that degrade and destroy women. Yet boys at school infallibly lose the decent bashfulness which, at home, might have ripened into modesty. I have already commented on the bad habits females acquire when they are shut up together, and I think that the observation may fairly be extended to the other sex, leading us to the conclusion that I have had in view throughout, namely that to improve both sexes they ought to be educated together, not only in private families, but also in public schools. If boys and girls were permitted to pursue the same studies together, they might learn early the graceful decencies that produce modesty, lessons of politeness and decorum. That rule-book that treads on the heels of falsehood would be made useless by habitual propriety of behaviour. If marriage is the cement of society, mankind should all be educated after the same model, or the interactions between the sexes will never deserve the name of fellowship, and women will never fulfil the special duties of their sex till they become enlightened citizens, till they become free, by being enabled to earn their own livings independently of men, in the way that one man is independent of another. Indeed, marriage will never be held sacred till women, by being brought up with men, are prepared to be their companions rather than their mistresses. So convinced am I of this truth that I venture to predict that virtue will never prevail in society till the virtues of both sexes are founded on reason, until the affections common to both are allowed to gain their due strength by the discharge of mutual duties. A taste for the fine arts requires great cultivation, but not more than a taste for the virtuous affections, and both demand the enlargement of mind that opens up so many sources of mental pleasure. Why do people hurry to noisy scenes and crowded circles? I should answer because they lack activity of mind, because they have not cherished the virtues of the heart. So they see and feel without taking in any details, and continually pine after variety, finding insipid everything that is simple. I have seen someone throw down with a languid yawn an admirable poem that a man of true taste returns to again and again with rapture, and on an occasion when a melody had made me almost unable to breathe, a lady asked me where I bought my gown. I have seen also an eye glance coldly over a most exquisite picture, and then sparkling with pleasure rest on a rudely sketched caricature. While some terrific feature in nature has spread a sublime stillness through my soul, I have been asked to observe the pretty tricks of a lapdog, belonging to a woman whom my perverse fate forced me to travel with. Is it surprising that such a tasteless being would rather caress this dog than her children? Or that she should prefer the rant of flattery to the simple accents of sincerity? Men of the first genius and most cultivated minds apparently had the highest relish for the simple beauties of nature, and they must have forcibly felt what they have so well described, the charm that natural affections and unsophisticated feelings spread around the human character. It is this power of looking into the heart and responsively vibrating with each emotion that enables the poet to personify each passion, and a painter to sketch with a pencil of fire. True taste is always the work of the understanding, employed in observing natural effects. Until women have more understanding, it is vain to expect them to possess domestic taste. Their lively senses will always be at work to harden their hearts, and the emotions created in them will continue to be vivid and transitory, unless a proper education stores their minds with knowledge. It is the lack of domestic taste, not the acquirement of knowledge, that takes women out of their families and tears the smiling babe from the breast that ought to nourish it. Women have been allowed to remain in ignorance and slavish dependence for very many years, and still we hear of nothing but their fondness for pleasure and sway, their preference for rakes and soldiers, their childish attachments to toys, and the vanity that makes them value accomplishments more than virtues. History brings forward a fearful catalogue of the crimes that their cunning has produced, when the weak slaves have had enough skill to overreach their masters. In France, and many other countries, men have been the luxurious despots, and women the crafty ministers. Does this prove that ignorance and dependence domesticate them? Is not their folly well known to the libertines who relax in their company? And do not men of sense continually lament that an immoderate fondness for dress and dissipation permanently distracts a mother from her home? Their hearts have not been debauched by knowledge, nor their minds led astray by scientific pursuits, yet they do not fulfil the special duties which nature calls on them as women to fulfil. On the contrary, the state of warfare that subsists between the sexes makes them employ those wiles that often frustrate the male's more open designs of force. When, therefore, I call women slaves, I mean this in a political and civil sense, for indirectly they obtain too much power, and their efforts to get this illicit power debase them. So let an enlightened nation run an experiment to discover how far reason would bring women back to nature and their duty. Let them share the advantages of education and government with man, and see whether they become better as they grow wiser and become free. They can't be injured by the experiment, because it's not in the power of man to make them more insignificant than they are at present. To make this practicable, day schools for particular ages should be established by government, in which boys and girls might be educated together. The school for the younger children from 5 to 9 years of age ought to be absolutely free and open to all classes. a sufficient number of masters should be chosen by a select committee in each parish, to whom complaints of negligence, etc., could be made if signed by 6 of the children's parents. I am advocating the creation of elementary day schools, where boys and girls, rich and poor, would meet together. To prevent any of the distinctions of vanity, they should be dressed alike, and all obliged to submit to the same discipline. The schoolroom ought to be surrounded by a large piece of ground in which the children could have exercise, because at this age they shouldn't be confined to any sedentary task for more than an hour at a time. But these playtimes could all be made a part of elementary education, for many things improve and occupy the senses when introduced as a kind of show, things that children would turn a deaf ear to if their principles were dryly laid down. For instance, botany, mechanics, and astronomy could all be taught in practical ways out of doors. Reading, writing, arithmetic, natural history, and some simple experiments in natural philosophy could fill up the rest of the day. But these pursuits should never encroach on gymnastic play in the open air. The elements of religion, history, the history of man, and politics could be taught by conversations in the Socratic form. After the age of 9, girls and boys who are intended for domestic employment or mechanical trades should be transferred to other schools and be given instruction that is to some degree adapted to where each individual pupil is headed. The two sexes should still be together in the morning, but in the afternoon the girl should attend a school where simple sewing, dressmaking, millinery, etc. would be their employment. Young people of superior abilities or fortune might now be taught, in another school, the dead and living languages, the elements of science, and more on history and politics, on a more extensive scale that wouldn't exclude literature. Girls and boys still together? I hear some readers ask. Yes. And I wouldn't fear any consequence, except that there might be some early girl-boy attachment that didn't perfectly agree with the views of the parents, though it had an excellent effect on the moral character of the young people. I'm afraid that we are a long way from having a world that is so enlightened that parents, anxious only to make their children virtuous, will let them choose companions for life themselves. Besides, this would be a sure way to promote early marriages, and early marriages naturally have the most salutary physical and moral effects. What can be more indelicate than a girl's coming out in the fashionable world? That is the process of bringing to market a marriageable miss, whose person is taken from one public place to another, richly adorned. Compare the motivations for this idle routine, with the dignified attachments that the young of both sexes would form in the schools that I have sketchily described. What I am offering here is only an outline of the plan I have in mind, not the fully detailed plan. But I must include one detail that I highly approve of in the regulations presented in Monsieur Talleyrand's pamphlet, mentioned earlier. It is the proposal to make the children and youths independent of the masters in respect to punishments. They should be tried by their peers, which would be an admirable method of fixing sound principles of justice in the mind, and might have an excellent effect on a child's temperament, which is very early soured or irritated by tyranny, until it becomes peevishly cunning or ferociously overbearing. I know it will be said that woman would be unsexed by acquiring strength of body and mind, and that beauty, soft, bewitching beauty, would no longer adorn the daughters of men. I think, on the contrary, that we would then see dignified beauty and true grace arising from many powerful physical and moral causes. It wouldn't be relaxed beauty, or the graces of helplessness, but the beauty that appears to make us respect the human body. In ancient Greek sculptures, as a majestic structure, fit to receive a noble inhabitant, a wonderful body fit to house a noble soul. I do not forget the popular opinion that the Grecian statues were not modelled according to the proportions of a particular man, but that beautiful limbs and features were selected from various bodies to form a harmonious whole. This might in some degree be true. The fine ideal picture of an exalted imagination might be superior to the materials the painter found in nature, and thus it might fairly be called the model of mankind, rather than of a man. What burst forth from such a statue, however, was not the mechanical selection of limbs and features, but the boiling up of a heated fancy, and the artist's fine senses and enlarged understanding selected the solid matter that he drew into this glowing focus. I believe that the human form must then have been far more beautiful than it is at present. Back then, it was not prevented from expanding and taking its natural shape by the extreme indolence, the barbarous strapping in, and the many other causes that forcibly act on it in our luxurious state of society. Looking at it purely physically, exercise and cleanliness appear to be the surest means not only of preserving health, but of promoting beauty. But this is not sufficient. Moral causes must also come into it, or beauty will be merely of that rustic kind that blooms on the innocent, wholesome countenances of some country people whose minds have not been exercised. To render the person perfect, the physical and moral beauty ought to be attained at the same time, each lending and receiving force by the combination. Judgment must reside on the brow, affection and fancy beam in the eye, and humanity curve the cheek. Otherwise, there is no value in the sparkling of the finest eye or the elegantly turned finish of the fairest features. And grace and modesty should appear in every motion that displays the active limbs and well-knit joints. But this fair assemblage is not to be brought together by chance. It is the reward of exertions met to support each other, for judgment can only be acquired by reflection, affection only by the discharge of duties, and humanity only by the exercise of compassion to every living creature. Humanity to animals should be particularly taught as a part of national education, for it is not at present one of our national virtues. Gentleness towards their domestic animals among the lower class is more often found in savage states than in civilized ones. The dealings with animals that create affection in the crude hut or mud cabin are prevented by civilization, which leads uncultivated minds, who are depraved by being trodden down by the rich, to domineer over their animals, to revenge the insults they have to bear from their social superiors. This habitual cruelty is first caught, like catching a disease, at school, where the boys have great sport tormenting the miserable animals that they come across. Growing up, they easily shift from barbarity towards animals to domestic tyranny over wives, children, and servants. Neither justice nor even benevolence will be a powerful spring of action, unless it extends to the whole creation. Indeed, I believe it can be accepted as an axiom that those who can see pain without being moved will soon learn to inflict it. I don't like to make a distinction without a difference, and I have to say that I have been as much disgusted by the fine lady who took her lapdog to her bosom instead of her child, as by the ferocity of a man who beat his horse, and declared that the horse knew when he did wrong, just as a Christian would. End of chapter 12.